right. We'll go on to case number 2024356, United States versus Douglas Pearson et al. And Mr. Stilley, are you going to be going first?
Yeah, may I please the court, counsel? My name is Oscar Stilley and I represent Arthur Hawkins. The Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution guarantees notice to persons charged with crimes in federal court. This notice is given by written indictment to allow the individual to prepare to meet the charges that have been made against that individual. The same notice that allows the individual to prepare for trial also tolls the statute of limitations in cases where there is an original indictment and a superseding indictment. In this case, the original indictment that supposedly gave notice to the defendant has been sealed. There was never any intention for either Mr. Hawkins or Mr. Pearson to ever lay eyes on that document or have any access to it, no matter how hard they tried.
Now, if, as Judge Herndon found, the only difference between the original indictment and the first superseding indictment has to do with an unindicted co-conspirator, then why would there be a statute of limitations problem? Allegations regarding an unindicted co-conspirator would not alter the nature of the charges, would they?
Your Honor, assuming everything that you said was true, I could agree with you. But if it was given to the defendant, then he would be able to have his constitutional right to counsel, and he could make the argument about whether or not that there was a material change. Now, we can say that there was a co-conspirator. The co-conspirator was the only one that was involved. But we see twice that Judge Herndon made comments about what the changes were. Once he said it was only about a co-conspirator, and another time he said it was just a little bit, there was only insubstantial changes.
But Mr. Stilley, I mean, I think the point is, you yourself noted that the indictment is serving at least two functions here. It's serving a statute of limitations function, and it's serving a notice function. Now, you're focusing on the fact that the notice part isn't really satisfied by a sealed indictment, which would be true if the sealed indictment came out during year two, just as if it came out right on the brink of year five, as this one did. And yet we do have sealed indictments rather commonly. And I think what the focus here has to be is whether, in a case where there's a challenge to whether the superseding indictment, we'll focus on the first one for right now, was the same as the one that came out within the statute of limitations. Is that something that the judge ascertained by comparing the two? Is that something that, by in some redacted form or some appropriate form, the lawyer for the defendant should ascertain? And secondarily, is it subject to harmless error analysis? As the Supreme Court has said in the Cotton case, indictment defects normally are. Because if it's subject to harmless error analysis, then even if the judge should have shown you the indictment, even if you're right about everything you're saying, in fact, we do have a sealed indictment here. The judge looked at it at the district court. This court can look at it. And if the differences are as trivial as the government says they are, then there's no harm.
Okay. Now, that's a new one on me. Are you telling me that the sealed indictment is before this court under seal?
Yes. Yes.
This
court can review. Well, of course, this court has the full record. We don't.
Okay. So you get a different record than the appellant gets?
Well, we get the sealed parts of the record.
Otherwise, we couldn't review what the district court judge did. You have to be able to look at the original indictment to compare it.
Certainly, and that was one of the main things. That was an important thing that I felt needed to be raised about this. Not only do we not have counsel, we have no appellate review. But now let's talk.
No, but you do have appellate review because it was under seal and we have access to it. I understand you wanted access to it, but we have access to it and can review and have looked at the original indictment and the superseding indictment. And indeed, as the judge found, it was just a substitution of names in the first superseding indictment, just as the court indicated. I mean, that's just the way the process works. We have to have access to sealed documents in order to review the record. So we do have that.
Also, Mr. Stilley, if the identity
of the unindicted co-conspirator was revealed in the pretrial papers, then what harm did the ruling of the original indictment pose to the defense?
Your Honor, I don't know that to be a fact. I haven't seen that original indictment, and with all due respect to the court, I think that the defendant is entitled to counsel.
But you got the pretrial papers, did you not?
The pretrial papers that
I'm looking at pages 29 and 30 of the government's brief, in which it says, in his own argument, Pearson, that's your co-counsel, of course, concedes that the government identified the unindicted co-conspirator in pretrial papers and was therefore able to cross-examine trial witnesses with this information.
Well, that's his supposition. I don't know anything about that. You'd have to, he'll be up here soon and you can ask him, but I don't know anything about that. I don't know who the unindicted co-conspirator is, and I presume you can't tell
me. Did you see all of the pretrial papers in this case?
I believe the whole case. I mean, it's an extremely large case, and I can't say that I can say everything off the top of my head, but I don't know who this is supposed to be. I mean, if it's supposedly public record, I would presume that the court could tell me who this supposed unindicted co-conspirator was. But it would seem to me, if that was a fact, there would be no basis for sealing the indictment.
Well, I mean, that's a whole different question, but here's my hypothetical for you, Mr. Stewart. Again, getting back to my trying to separate out the reviewability point and the notice point. Suppose the original sealed indictment had charged your client only with felony violations of the antitrust laws, and then along comes the first superseding indictment with this wire fraud charge, alleging the wire fraud at the same time it actually was alleged, which was back in January. At that point, once the district court reviews the two, the district court should have said, sorry, but the first superseding indictment is late because it's more than 5 years after the event mentioned. You can't relate it back because wire fraud, I'm at least hypothesizing for this case, is too different from an antitrust violation. End of discussion. And even if the district court made a mistake about that, this court could do it. Now, I fully understand that as counsel for the defendant, you, the lawyer, would like to be able to look at that sealed indictment and make a judgment. But if, in the end, it's true that there's no problem here with the statute of limitations, I would think the most you could get from this court would be a finding, if it were true that the government shouldn't have sealed it, that was a mistake, but there was no harm in the error. I don't see why, on the facts of these papers, there's any harm to your client.
It's possible that there would be no statute of limitations problem on that for this reason. The Schimmel and the Little cases both say that notice is the touchstone. The same notice that allows you to prepare for trial tolls the statute of limitations.
But no, you're saying then that any sealed indictment is insufficient to toll the statute of limitations. That the government can never use a sealed indictment, that indeed it has to give the indictment to, you know, has to have an arraignment, essentially, at which the defendant is served with a copy of the indictment before the statute of limitations is told. And I don't believe that's the law.
Well, we have a different situation than we've ever had in this country than we've ever had.
You've never had sealed indictments?
No, we've had sealed indictments, but we've never had a sealed indictment that has never been disclosed. I never had... you might have a different question on this if the original indictment was given to this individual sometime later. But how can you say that an indictment that was never shown to the defendant gave him notice?
He wasn't tried on that indictment. The only question is the later indictments. The indictment that he had to answer to in court was in his possession. It was the second superseding indictment.
Right.
And that was the indictment that had to structure the jury charges. That's the indictment that had to structure the evidence. He was tried on something that he knew about. He had the charging document. The only question is, was that charging document close enough to the one that was sealed to preserve the statute of limitations point?
Schimmel and Little don't say anything about being close enough. Schimmel and Little say notice is the touchstone, and you'll have a notice within 5 years. That's what they say, or whatever the statute of limitations is.
Mr. Spilly, forgive me, but you do not have a lot of time, and I think it's important that you go on to your next issue.
Sir.
Okay.
Subject matter jurisdiction, the government suggests that there is no subject matter jurisdiction requirement. They say, even though that the government's attorney throws their hands up and says, we don't have any evidence that these defendants caused the wire, sent the wire, or agreed to the wire, or even knew about the wire. But they're nonetheless responsible for the wire. The theory being, and this is a theory that they like to raise, is that because there was a conspiracy, everyone is responsible for everything that was done by any of the conspirators. What they forget is that there was no federal entitlementable conspiracy. Because a conspiracy, a federal wire requires two things. It requires a federal wire, that is interstate wire, and a nefarious purpose, a corrupt purpose. Just a corrupt purpose is not, that's not a federal conspiracy. That is why the government refuses to concede or to say what they claim that the conspiracy is. Because as long as they leave that unsaid, they can hit two bases at once, picking whichever position is advantageous to them at a given time without ever having to say what that conspiracy is.
Now, wasn't the charge the conspiracy one to commit wire fraud?
It wasn't charged a conspiracy to commit wire fraud, but as the government has to admit, they have no evidence that either these defendants committed the wire fraud or knew about the wire fraud or agreed to it. And those are the elements, respectively, for counts two and counts one. And I do see that my time was up, and I would like to reserve my argument. I would like
sure
to move the motion for study.
Good morning, Mr. Freifalt.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to begin and do a very quick touching on the question which we raised with regards to Rule 16C. And that is the batteries in question. There were almost 3 weeks of solid testimony in this trial with no reference to anything except the batteries they manufacture, etc. Shortly before the trial, we discovered through reviewing over 1.8 million documents which the government made available and a large machine that was the AccuBalance machine, which you'll see referred to in the transcript, we discovered that the government, in fact, had obtained possession of a large number of batteries, many of which were in the relevant period of time, many of which were also determined by, apparently, an expert who looked at it from the government to be a statistically significant sample. You may remember the testimony of Zader, where Zader says, in the manufacture of any product, over the course of time, there are defects, they are inherent. We requested by motion the opportunity to examine and asked the batteries, and asked for a delay of, I believe it was 4.5 weeks, the total delay to examine the batteries as well as 109 boxes of documents that for whatever reason had not been produced. That request was denied. It's our position, Your Honors, that under Rule 16C, we had an absolute right to inspect them, we had a right to have them tested, and we had a right, as Mr. Pearson did, to prove through testimony that it was a statistically significant sample, and through expert testimony that, in fact, the battery defect rate in these batteries in response to the government's case in chief were no greater than that in any industrial production.
Suppose you had done that, and yet there was still evidence in the record that consumer complaints that were coming into Sears about these batteries and the amount of warranty work that was being done was vastly in excess of what Sears' experience had been under the prior manufacturer. Isn't that really what's important, Sears' perception of what this battery's performance was and its satisfaction with that battery?
It may have affected Sears' perception. That was not the issue the government tried. The issue the government tried was that these were designed improperly, they were fraudulently manufactured, and those design defects were concealed. That was the issue tried by the government's case in chief. That's what we had a right to respond to. So, and yes, ultimately it may have been a fact question had we produced that testimony and the government relied solely on complaints from customers on Sears. I remember I
believe. Did the government introduce evidence using these batteries saying here's the chemical composition of the battery, here's the materials they used, this is the amount of lead they had in them, and so on and so
they
forth?
They did not use the batteries, but yes, they did produce evidence from the people who manufactured them, evidence about reduction of the quantity of lead, evidence about the design defects. Yes, yes.
And did you have access to those same witnesses?
No, we had access to documents over a long period of time which touched on it. However, access to the witnesses as opposed to, if I can use the expression, access to the smoking gun for purposes of ballistics, I believe Mr. McQueen in the trial court made the analysis to the murder weapon. The government's going to say he was killed with a .22 caliber weapon, and Mr. Pearson owned it, but we're not going to let you inspect it or do ballistics on it.
Well, you knew who the witnesses were that the government was going to call, and did you ask for any of those witnesses? I know you got the
witnesses. We did not get a witness list in this case. We did not get an exhibit list in this case. We knew who the government was going to call when they took the stand in the courtroom, not even 24 hours before. We did not get an exhibit list in this case, although the court did get a set of binders.
But I thought there was one set given to the defense.
No.
No, in terms of the exhibit list, I thought there was one exhibit list and one witness list given to the defense.
No, absolutely not. You were given 3,500 material, which I believe covered, if memory serves me, in excess of 80 or 90 people. We were not given an exhibit list. In fact, we describe in our brief how during the course of the trial, the government would hand one copy of the exhibit in front of the jury, choose three attorneys for the defendant in open court, and the court would open its binder with the seal of the United States attorney on it from the bench. And when that issue was raised, of course, it's clear from the transcript, I think it's the March 26th transcript, that the court took offense that we had suggested that was an ex parte communication. But indeed, the judge told the jury at the start, we don't even know who the witnesses are, and indeed we did not. We were forced to scour the countryside, if I can use that expression, to try and identify the name of the witness for the next day. And indeed, in one instance, I believe the only instance we asked for a delay in the trial, we asked Judge Herndon for 15 to 20 minutes to get the witness binder from the hotel, which was about a half hour away, and that was denied. So in the context of this trial, no, we did not know who was going to take the stand, and no way that we could marshal it in that fashion. The second point I want to move on to very quickly is the Brady issue, and I say the Brady issue because the government argues that false exculpatory statements are not Brady.
I just want to get back so I can clear up on this exhibit list. In your argument at page 18, you say the government refused to provide a witness with an exhibit list or a pre-marked set of exhibits, instead requiring that only one copy of an exhibit be circulated amongst defense counsel. No, that's in your
brief. That was circulated in front of the jury. The one copy was actually handed over in front of the jury with the witness on the stand. We got at the same time, and that was of the exhibit. We did not mean to say an exhibit list.
And what about a witness list?
Witnesses we found out when they came in the courtroom.
Well, I was saying in your brief you talk about one set. I thought you were referring to one set of the witness list.
No, I'm talking about one set of the actual physical exhibits was handed over in the courtroom. And I apologize if that was misworded. I was going to move on very quickly to the Brady issue. The government and us have a serious divergence. We believe Brady does not have a, if the government doesn't believe the witness statement exception. The false exculpatory argument the government respectfully submits is not Brady. Clearly, in this case, the statements of Alan Gauthier to the government pre-sentence was Brady material. The Lee Hawkins material was Brady. I'm not going to re-argue what's in our brief. The third point I want to get to very quickly is with regards to Joseph Calio. The case against Douglas Pearson boils down to Joseph Calio. And there are three aspects of the Calio testimony which I think is important. Number one, on the restriction of cross-examination of Mr. Calio, the so-called sanctions against Ms. Fleming. You may remember from the record in that case, Ms. Fleming allegedly said to the attorney for the witness, since the witness had testified of not fully disclosing to the government, if I were you, I'd talk to the government. Now, that was not Ms. Fleming going to the attorney. Everyone testified that the attorney came from the back of the courtroom up to the well of the court, a former FBI agent he happens to be, and requested her input, and she said, according to the record, worst case scenario, I'm not going to give you legal advice, but if I were you, I'd talk to the government to determine whether they're going to stick to the deal. That was exactly the same cross-examination which she had done. I submit there was nothing improper about that, but even if there was, I respectfully submit that the limitation of cross-examination here was, in view of the significance of Calio, was abusive beyond imagination.
Well, in what sense
was your examination of Mr. Kelly hampered, you know, by the court's auxiliary determination. The government suggests that the airplane tickets and the passports were fully inquired into.
Let me separate two. That's really the 608B argument. With regards to the continued examination, Mr. Callio, the night before, Judge Herndon had required a detailed outline of what we were going to use Callio for and found it to be relevant and material. So the preclusion the next day, I respectfully submit, is preclusion of relevant and material testimony of a witness who was called by Mr. McQueen as part of the defense case. With regards to 608B material, the airplane tickets, the passport entry, etc., whether or not at the time of the first payment there was actually a conspiracy existence, or whether Joe Callio was off on a walk, he raised over $15,000 by the double billing, which we wanted to prove, by the airline tickets, which we wanted to prove, which would have given him $5,000 in his pocket, $10,000 to pay Mark, at a point in time where Joe Callio's career at Exide was made because of the Sears contract. And we were deprived the opportunity to argue to the jury that at the time of the first payment, the very and only time that there is any suggestion that Douglas Pearson said anything to Callio about making payments, that there was not, in fact, a conspiracy. Now, whether the jury would have believed that or not, I respectfully submit these are not other bad acts. They are not 608B material. They are, in fact, intrinsic evidence going to the existence or non-existence of the conspiracy, the crime charge, and clearly the defendant still has the right to utilize that material. And so that's why I break the Callio down into two parts, the restriction with regards to the examination. The third point that I would like to touch very quickly on is Sears' pretrial intervention agreement. And that boils down to the fact that this jury was allowed to hear that Sears paid an enormous sum of money as a, quote, criminal fine. I believe Jenkins and the other cases cited in the brief indicate that the use of pretrial intervention as a way of, especially here, a substantive evidence to somehow change the process and establish that Sears had paid a great deal of money, I think is improper, and I think we covered that adequately in our brief. The last area that I would like to touch on very quickly is the question of sentence disparity. If one lays out the sentences imposed in this case and Mr. Pearson's involvement in this case, I see my light is on. I'll stop now and save my time for rebuttal if that's all right.
Surely.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. Ms. McClellan.
Good morning, Your Honor. Counsel. The defendants have conceded by not raising in their post-trial motions or as an argument on this appeal that the evidence was sufficient to support the verdict of the jury on count one and count two in this case. It is very telling that there is no sufficiency of evidence argument in this case. I will respond directly to the arguments then as they were made. I believe the court fully inquired as to the relation back doctrine. I think it is the court does have access to the sealed documents. The judge did make a correct finding in the record, and in any case, it would be harmless error. And
I don't know if you can respond to this, but I have to tell you, I was wondering why the allegations regarding the indicted co-conspirator that you know were included in the first place, you know, why they were included. In the first place, if they weren't vital to the charges and they were sensitive enough to require this kind of permanent sealing.
Well, they were vital. The bottom line, and for those of the court here, I think, who are former prosecutors, know that oftentimes when a case goes to indictment, it hasn't been resolved with all of the co-conspirators, and at that time it was not resolved. The case had to be indicted. And at some later time, it did become resolved, at which time it did become appropriate to disclose in pretrial papers, as Pearson admits at page 45 of his brief, at that time it was appropriate to disclose the identity of the unindicted co-conspirator.
But why wasn't it appropriate to unseal at that point? Because, you know, we have a public court system, after all, and
There's a time and a place for everything, and I certainly have seen plenty of instances where there's a time for sealing, but once sealed, things don't stay sealed forever.
There are two reasons it remains sealed.
One is sealed today, and well, it is sealed.
One because Department of Justice policy does not allow the government to take a position to unseal that document. We are bound by Department of Justice policy, which says...
Was there a motion to unseal?
Originally, there was one made before the case was ultimately resolved. Once it was disclosed who the unindicted co-conspirator was, there was no additional motion to unseal.
Is it necessary to continue to maintain that indictment?
Under the premises of Finger and Filler, yes, I do. Because there are cases from other jurisdictions. We didn't have a case out of the Seventh Circuit, but other jurisdictions held that where the prosecutor took the position allowing the court to unseal and identify an unindicted co-conspirator at any point in time, the prosecutor was guilty of misconduct. And frankly, the government was not going to place itself, based on that existing line of cases, in the position where we could be accused of misconduct.
So you now believe that we have to keep this indictment under seal.
Under the circumstances under which that unindicted co-conspirator was charged, correct, because the information that was filed may or may not be the same as the charges in the indictment. And so you are talking about exposure of that unindicted co-conspirator, which is not known to the public.
So are you now saying that the information that you revealed later on is not the same as the information in the indictment?
It very much was.
So if you're making the representation that it's the same, I can understand that you, the prosecutor, may not wish to support unsealing. But you're only one party to this case. And the court has the power, ultimately. This court constantly tells people when appeals are filed that we will not maintain things under seal, even if they were under seal in the district court.
We're taking the position that we are going to do nothing to harm the interest, the financial and business interests of the unindicted co-conspirator in this case. That's my job.
And about whom everything is now known, you've just told me.
Well, Your Honor, to the extent that the information and the stipulation of fact and the pretrial diversion agreement disclosed that information, that much is known. That's correct.
Right. So then everything is open. So there's no, we understand your position, but we can definitely unseal if we wish. And what the point is, the name is out there. He's testified. His agreement is out there. So there's nothing in that first indictment that is, quote, secret anymore, or that would, quote, harm him because the information has already been revealed. That's what we're trying to get at. So we understand your position, and you're just saying the court has the authority to unseal.
The court has the authority to do that, but the government must take the position. And under Finn versus Schiller, by the way, I'm not even allowed to talk about the interests of that third party of the unindicted co-conspirator. I cannot represent those interests. And unless that unindicted co-conspirator's counsel is here to argue that point, I mean, they may have some other reason that the government has not anticipated as to why they don't want it unsealed. All I can say is we're doing our job and we're doing it ethically, and that's why we took the position we did in the trial court.
To the extent that an indictment serves a notice function, weren't the defendants deprived of that notice until after the statute of limitation expired, and would that present a problem?
Not at all, Your Honor, because the judge ascertained by comparing the two documents that the change was de minimis. The standard, remember, is whether or not it materially broadens or amends the indictment.
But here's my question. Maybe it's the same as Judge Rosner's. These particular defendants never saw any indictment until the first superseding indictment. Isn't that correct?
That's when they were arrested.
Well, just so in other words, to rephrase my question or to repeat it, they never saw any indictment until March. Right, okay. So March is more than 5 years after the wire fraud incident that is asserted as liability. So they never knew they were in criminal trouble until more than 5 years had passed. They never knew that there was an indictment against them. They never knew there was an indictment against them until a period of time greater than 5 years had elapsed.
And the court...
And so they had no notice that they were being indicted until after the statute of limitations would have run.
Well...
Suppose it's 10 years. Suppose you return a sealed indictment